I'm sorry for the delay. We'll go ahead and get started. Welcome to everybody. My name is Mary Tara Ross, and I'm the director of the Clinical Research and Services Office that puts on this exchange date every month. And I'm really happy to welcome Carolyn Dunbar Masterson and Matt Stafford, who work at Boston Children's Hospital. Carolyn is a research nurse in the Department of Cardiology, and Matt is the Assistant Director of Clinical Research Compliance for Boston Children's. And I had the great opportunity to meet both of them over the summer where they gave the talk, and I really liked it and the way they did it, and I thought it was to be a great seminar. So I hope you enjoy this as much as I did when they first came, and I really appreciate your generosity coming out here again. I guess without further ado, they did tell me they would provide a little bit more in the way of introduction about themselves, and so you'll hear that. And thank you for attending.
All right, so I was asked to tell a little bit about myself and also mention one thing that doesn't have anything to do with work.
Yeah.
So my title is sort of a fancy way of saying that I'm the IRB office manager at Children's Hospital. I've been doing this for about 15 years now. I started at Columbia University for social science IRB, and I've been at Children's for a little over, or just about 10 years now. I'm a MPH student here at Boston University at night, so you might see me at nighttime walking around the halls with a bunch of books. And I like to eat spicy food, and I like to run long distance, and I've run a few marathons. Carolyn, do you want to say something about yourself?
Oh, sure.
Before we start?
Sure. I'm Carolyn, hello. I work at Children's Hospital for about 15 years as well, and most of that time I've coordinated studies in the cardiovascular program, mostly with one main overall PI, but also helping a lot of other PIs. I also like to run, not as far as you. I like yoga, and I don't like spicy food.
And from the IRB side, I can tell you that Carolyn's studies are always pretty tight, and her PIs, I hope they know what a good thing they have. So your submissions are always in pretty good shape by the time we see them. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of the basic stuff that if you've taken the CITI course or you've been involved with submitting protocols to an IRB or dealing with IRB conditional approval letters and things like that, you'll be familiar with anyway. We'll talk about some of the specific regulations and considerations dealing with minors, children in research, and we'll give you a chance to practice applying those. We'll sort of put you in the seat of the IRB members for a few minutes. And just by a show of hands, how many of you have taken the CITI course like in the last 2 years or so? And how many of you have been to an IRB meeting? Okay. And how many of you are actively engaged in research that's reviewed or approved by an IRB? Okay, cool. So a lot of this won't be new to you. So the first half of this will probably go, if I go too fast, let me know, but I'm trying not to bore you with stuff you already know. Also, if you have any questions, please speak loudly because it's being recorded and I think this is the only microphone. So I'll try not to burp because I drink that Pepsi kind of fast. All right. So this is how we'll do it. We'll start off by talking about the IRB review criteria, special considerations that apply to children in research, and then we'll have a few case studies. All right. So in order for an IRB to approve a study, it has to agree that it meets certain criteria. Those criteria are an attempt to like sort of codify the basic ethical principles of the Belmont Report. Those principles are respect for persons, the idea that individuals should be respected as autonomous agents with the right and the ability to make their own determinations regarding their welfare and well-being. Beneficence, the idea that not only you should do no harm, but where possible, provide a benefit. And justice, the idea that the same people or groups of people that bear that will benefit from the research are analogous to or the same as those that will bear the burden of the research. Respect for persons is accomplished through a robust informed consent process. Beneficence is accomplished by appropriate assessment and balancing of the risks and benefits of the research. And justice through adequate selection of subjects, not based on convenience, but based on sound principle. So the regulations, which are an attempt to sort of enforce those or spell out like a pathway to those, say that the IRB has 7, sometimes 8 or more criteria for approval. The IRB has to determine that it meets all these criteria before they can give it its blessing. First criteria is that risk to subjects are minimized by using procedures consistent with sound research design without unnecessarily exposing subjects to risks. So, for example, the study should be adequately designed so that it will actually achieve what it sets out to do, so you won't put people at risk or even inconvenience for a study that won't stand up to peer review or that, you know, will have meaningless results that can't be generalized. Where appropriate, things that are already being done to the subjects can be used. For example, if there's already a chest X-ray in the patient's record that's recent, you wouldn't expose them to the risk of another. Or if they're already having blood drawn at certain times, you wouldn't stick them again if you can just sort of get a little bit extra from that main draw. The next criteria is that the risks to subjects are reasonable in relation to the anticipated benefits, if any, and the importance of the knowledge that may be expected to result. And in this, the IRB should consider the risks that result from the research, not the things that the subjects would encounter anyway, like not the aspects of standard of care that they would benefit from. And in this, the long-range effects of applying the knowledge shouldn't be weighed as heavily as the immediate benefits to the participant, benefits or risks to the participant. Selection of subjects should be equitable. This should be based on sound principle. There should be good scientific reasons for enrolling the people that you want to enroll. Shouldn't simply be a population of a convenience. They should be, there should be a good reason for enrolling who you want to enroll. The next criteria is that informed consent will be sought from the subject or their legally authorized representative, be it a parent, guardian, or other delegated person. And in most cases, consent is required, but there are obviously a lot of exceptions, especially in the cases of minimal risk research, things like retrospective chart reviews and whatnot. And then also, when required, again, it's usually required, but not always, consent will be appropriately documented. And that little reference there goes on to 46.117 goes on to explain the situations in which you can conduct research without documenting consent. Usually it has to do with research where it's no greater than minimal risk and or the consent document would increase the risk to subjects if it's sort of, you know, an acknowledgement of something kind of sensitive. Any questions so far? when appropriate, the research plan should make adequate provisions for monitoring the data. So a good data safety monitoring plan. Noticing when you know, if disturbing trends are arising or if you're reaching a point of futility, it should alter or halt the trial to preserve safety of the research subjects. When appropriate, adequate provisions to protect the privacy of subjects and to maintain the confidentiality of their data. And then in some cases where the subjects are in a vulnerable population, additional protections should be applied. And the regulations spell out specifically guidelines for protecting pregnant women and fetuses, prisoners, and also children. So we'll talk about the part that deals with the children. So in order to approve a research study involving minors, the IRB has to determine that those criteria that we just went through are met, and also they have to fit the protocol into one of these categories. The first is research not involving greater than minimal risk. The next one, research that does pose greater than minimal risk to subjects, but with a prospect for benefit to those same subjects. The next category, research involving greater than minimal risk, but no prospect of direct benefit to those subjects, but still likely to yield generalizable knowledge about that subject's disorder or condition. And then the next category, which is one of the rarest ones, research not otherwise approvable, can't be fit into any of those square pegs above, but still preventing an opportunity to understand, prevent, or alleviate the problem. Essentially, this is something that an IRB might decide is important and ethical, but they can't rationally fit it into any of those categories. The majority of IRB meeting time is spent trying to figure out whether something is here or here, at least at our IRB. All right, so if the research is no greater than minimal risk, and the definition of minimal risk being that no greater probability of harm than you would encounter in daily life for an average person. So the IRB would be able to approve this if they can meet all the other criteria and there's appropriate provisions where required for obtaining assent of the children and permission of the parents. The next category, one step up, this is probably in a medical center where a lot of research protocols fall. Which there's more than minimal risk to the children, but the intervention or procedure from which the risk originates also holds out the prospect of direct benefit for the subjects, or sometimes by an added feature of the study, additional monitoring or things like that that are available to them only in the context of the research. These can be approved if the IRB finds that the risks are justified by the benefits, so the risk-benefit ratio is appropriate, reasonable, the relationship of that makes sense in the framework of what is available to them through alternative approaches, other available treatments, and adequate provisions are made for getting the child's assent and permission of the parents. The next category of research is a little trickier. This is where there is more than minimal risk to the subjects, but there is no direct benefit potential. In these cases, an IRB can approve the study only if they determine that the risk represents a minor increase over minimal risk, which is a term not defined by the federal regulations, but OHRP has published recommendations made to OHRP by a presidential commission in which it's suggested that the regulations be more clear and define minor increase as being risks that are non-permanent, that are transient, reversible things. So not risks like dismemberment or death so much as, like something that can be treated and dealt with quickly. the intervention or procedure, which is the contentious, risky thing, prevents experiences commensurate with what those same subjects encounter in the routine of their life, whether be their daily life or something peculiar to them as a study population. Any questions so far? So I meant to connect the dots on that recommendation. The definition, the fact that OHRP has published that on their website is sort of like a tacit acceptance of that without going through the formality of changing the regulations, which is an arduous process. So the research procedures that are posing the risks to the subjects have to be done to yield generalizable knowledge about that subject's disorder or condition. It can't be something to study some other unrelated group. Adequate provisions have to be made for soliciting the assent of the children and permission of the parents. The regulations require that for this category of research, where there is no potential for benefit, where possible, permission of both parents is obtained, where both parents are reasonably available. Now, most people would interpret reasonably available or not reasonably available to mean something like, an estranged parent or someone, if there's like a restraining order or deceased or whereabouts unknown, simply being like unable to get out of work that day or something like that would typically not justify not getting their permission. This next category of research is kind of rare. It's a kind of the ephemera of pediatric research ethics. The 407 process happens when an IRB feels that a research study should take place. It's ethical, it's appropriate, and the knowledge to be gained is important, but they can't fit it into any of those categories. Usually this happens where they can't determine that it's either a minor increase over minimal risk, like it's really more than a minor increase, or that the experiences are not really commensurate with what that group encounters. And these then are then referred to either the Secretary of Health and Human Services, or if it's an FDA-regulated product that's being studied, to the FDA commissioner. They then convene a group of experts, I think a minimum of 10 experts. There's a public comment period, and notice published in the Federal Register. The public has a chance to comment on this. And then the secretary then decides, after consulting with the experts, whether or not to allow the study or not. And it's kind of interesting. You can actually look at the OHRP website. They've archived the ones that have gone through the secretary's office. You can see the witness test, the expert testimonies, all the expert opinions. You can see the minutes of the IRB that didn't approve it. Sometimes you'll see the minutes or IRB documents from other IRBs that did approve it first. And I'll guarantee, whenever a notice like this goes out, IRB people all over the country check really quick to make sure they didn't just approve that study and say that there was a potential for benefit, and then find out that it's being elevated in a very public way. So it's not a very common occurrence, but when it does happen, it's kind of exciting for an IRB person, I guess. And those experts usually come back with things, statements. Either some people will disagree. They'll say that it should have been approved, they'll find a potential for benefit, or find that it really is a minor increase for some reason or other. And if you read those, you'll find that these are really tricky cases. Even the experts don't agree. Usually the votes are something like 3-3 and 1, or 4-4 and 2, or something like that. Very variable. All right. All right, so now I'll let Carolyn talk about some studies that she is intimately familiar with, because she was involved with them.
That's right.
And does everyone have the handout, the research criteria? Okay, yeah. We'll be using those a little bit.
Yeah, I think they have some extra. Enough people can hear me? Okay, great. Okay. So as a research coordinator, I tried to go through some studies that seemed like they were a little bit more challenging in terms of the risk-benefit ratios, and I just wanted to present them. I'm presenting them a little bit broadly instead of identifying the studies directly, just to get a picture, and I might change some of the details just for more discussion. So the first study I wanted to tell you about, it's an interventional trial that we did in pediatric cardiovascular surgery. It was a study that was done across 14 or 15 centers, and the intervention was to randomize children who are undergoing cardiac surgery in the first month of life to one of two modifications of that surgery, and then following those outcomes. So all eligible subjects had to be scheduled for this first stage of surgery. It was clinically required, and then that was the first eligibility criteria. And then after consent and approval of clinicians, then the children would be randomized again to one or two of types of surgical modifications. So just to give you some background on the patient population. So for this patient population, all the infants had complex congenital heart disease, uniformly fatal. And the treatment options are heart transplant, which is less feasible in our country, in the world. And the other option is a staged palliation. And typically the children undergo 3 cardiac surgeries in the newborn period, about 6 months of age, and then again between 18 months and 3 years of age. And they can have lots of other procedures in the interim. So the mortality for this patient population has been high for a couple of decades, and although the mortality rate has come down, it has not come down dramatically, and still between 26% and 36%, even at the most experienced centers. So again, just a focus on that first surgery that has the highest mortality. The surgery that is done to address at this first surgery has been done for a couple of decades. And more recently, there was a modification to that surgery. So the surgery has basically four components. And one component, some centers did a different modification, and they reported lower mortality. So as this spread through the cardiovascular community, the experts in the field, the cardiologists and the cardiac surgeons got together and thought, well, we actually don't know which modification is better, the one we've standardly been doing, even though we're not calling it necessarily standard of care, or this new modification. And so the details. Or it's a stage one Norwood, and there's one or two ways of getting, there's a few ways of getting blood to the lungs, but this trial looked at two different ways of getting blood flow to the lungs. So the other things the study offered, aside from randomization and then closely following these patients to 14 months of age, we collected every bit of data possibly, and endless adverse event data, which I brought over to Matt Daly. It also offered neurodevelopmental evaluation at 14 months of age, and that evaluation was only available through the study. The results were shared with clinicians, but it was the only mechanism to get this neurodevelopmental evaluation was through the study, and also genetic evaluation. We did genetic evaluations prior to discharge after the first surgery, then again at 14 months of age. And again, just collecting a great deal of medical data. So when you think of what are the risks and benefits of the subject, we don't know which shunt or which modification is truly better. There's truly a sense of equipoise in the community. But if one shunt is better, it obviously will hopefully offer lower mortality. And then the other considerations that everybody had thought about, well, what if one center does one shunt much better than the other? Or what if one surgeon does? How do we accommodate or control for that? And then the neurodevelopmental evaluation at 14 months of age, although it's a benefit if we have high mortality, you know, signing families on and describing this benefit where their child may not receive it, if their child expires. So then how would one categorize this study? So we thought we'd sort of break here and see what people thought. I only included the first three categories. Is it greater than minimal risk? Is it greater than minimal risk but presenting a prospect of direct benefit to the subject? Greater than minimal risk with no prospect for direct benefit but likely to yield generalizable knowledge. Anybody have any initial thoughts?
Or do you have any questions that you would ask first, yeah, if you were on the IRB before you could make that determination? Yes.
So would, if the subject didn't participate, if the infant didn't participate but instead just presented with this, would the surgeons choose one or the other on the basis of some characteristic?
That's a perfect question. Yes. So there would be a few circumstances where the surgeon would rule out one of the shunts, and that was actually in our inclusion-exclusion criteria. So there's a few anatomic variants that one shunt would be more difficult to place, and so those subjects were not included in the randomization. So otherwise, if they didn't have, if a subject didn't have an anatomic variant like that, then the surgeon would choose whatever shunt he or she was more comfortable with. Yeah.
Do you expect the genetic evaluation to change between the periods?
We didn't expect it to change. Why? We did it at the two different time points. So we would consent the subjects before surgery, but then after surgery, before discharge, the patients would still be recovering from surgery, and so some of the characteristics that would be appreciated in a genetic evaluation may not have been as obvious in that first month of life, say. And so we thought having the geneticist then again see them at 14 months of age with a little more information in the interim, they may change their diagnosis, but they would have more information to work with. But we also wanted to offer it before, at that first stage of surgery, so that we would get as much information in case some of those subjects expired.
Sure. What the standard of practice across other academic children's institutions? So within a similar situation, are there surgeons doing one procedure versus other, or they pick and choose, okay, I'm going to, based on the anatomic variance, that, you know, what's the standard of care?
Right.
And are all the pediatric surgeons trained to do this procedure?
Yep, exactly. So to be part of the network that would be doing the study, all the surgeons at an institution had to say they'd be willing to participate and demonstrate the ability to do both surgeries. So the centers that may have one or two surgeons, where one surgeon could do both and the other said, no, I'm not comfortable with being randomized, essentially, that center wouldn't be included at all. So all the surgeons had to say that they were proficient in both procedures and that they were willing to be randomized. So that's a very good question. So in terms of standard of care, the surgeons that were involved would typically do both shunts. But in saying that, there are definitely surgeons who had been operating for 20 years who had done one standardly or just routinely done one shunt because the other shunt hadn't existed yet. So 15 years of their career, they were doing just the first type, and then the last 5 years would be doing both. Sean, was there a question on this side?
I have a question.
Oh, sure.
Was there any concern that, you know, like a physician who's done the same one for 20 years and only done a few of the other way, a bias, like, you know, if somebody's doing something that they don't believe works, they might not do it as well or with the same, you know.
In other words,
was there anything put in place to sort of like help account for that or protect against that?
Right, and I don't know that we were able to protect, but what we did was we stratified by center and then we stratified by surgeon so that each surgeon would have basically, would do the shunts equally. So there wouldn't be one surgeon happen to do all of one and one surgeon happen to do all the other type of shunt. But to control for, we did take years of experience into account, and when we did the analyses, we did see at ends of the spectrum that there was, but not as much as one might expect, but a surgeon who had had close to 30 years experience, outcomes are basically identical, but someone else who was close to had a better outcome with the older shunt. And you could say, well, maybe that was based on years of experience with that shunt.
I have another question. Okay. I would ask as an IRB member. How many different sites are doing this? How quickly do they expect to accrue subjects, and when will the DSMB meet to review progress?
That's perfect, yeah. So, 14 centers participated, and 555 subjects were enrolled in slightly less than 3 years. And so the DSMB met routinely, I think every 6 months, but then also there was a medical monitor who reviewed all of our serious adverse events. And so there was, you know, thought process during the study that if we were seeing that one shunt, you know, had a dramatically different mortality than the other or adverse events. So there's no point though during the trial that it was stopped for any concerns of that.
Okay. Was there a rule in place where if the adverse events were greater than expected or the demises were higher than they expected, where they would?
There probably was, but I don't recall specifically. They expected that if there was a true difference between the shunts, we would see that more of a 12% difference in mortality. But as we went through the study, I don't recall them having a threshold for when we, say, would stop the study. Say, would say with the first 100 patients, 70% versus 30% mortality. There probably was a threshold, but I don't recall it right now during the study.
So one question would be, you talked a little about the potential difference in mortality outcome, but are there any differences in the specifics of the procedure people have focused on? What is the standard of care at your institution? What would happen to an ordinary patient who came in? But are there differences in the risk to either procedure? Because that would weigh into me. I think otherwise people have argued if you truly have equipoise in a comparative effectiveness trial where either could be offered, you could say to the parent, I could do it this way, I could do it this way. In your case, I'm going to do it this way. And all you're losing is randomization from that conversation, that might be minimal risk. But I think that the initial question is that it would be probably greater than minimal risk, and you can argue whether the developmental assessment is some potential benefit. We've had that argument in other kinds of studies like this at our institution. It's a pretty small benefit. You'd want to know what happens at your institution with children who have this procedure, because that potential benefit might be quite minor. There's clearly a benefit to knowledge, if you know which is better for children. Right. So that's the easiest question.
Right. And so to go back to the first part of your statement, are there things about the different procedures that would have a different impact on risk? One shunt is considered more challenging to, or the patient who receives that shunt is considered a little bit more challenging to take care of in the early postoperative period. Mm-hmm. And so you think centers who have a lot of experience taking care of those subjects may have lower mortality. And with the other shunt, they think maybe long-term, the way the shunt is constructed could have longer term, perhaps negative impacts upon the heart, but there wasn't enough time to actually see that when the trial started. The children weren't old enough who had already received that shunt to see if that, but that was hypothesized as a potential risk of that type of shunt. But in the OR itself and in the immediate postoperative period, very, very similar. The length of the operation was essentially the same. The time of bypass or circulatory arrest, all those pieces in the operating room were very similar, and the pieces after in the postoperative, postoperative care were very similar as well. But there was some consideration that one shunt was more challenging in the early postoperative period.
You had a question also?
Oh, it's similar.
Okay. Anyone else from the IRB have a question?
So what was the benefit of the new shunt?
It's a little technical, but I'll try and explain it. The way that the shunts were designed, the one that had been done traditionally delivers blood flow to the lungs, and when the heart is contracting, it delivers blood flow to the lungs, and when the heart is resting, it still can deliver some to the lungs. With the other shunt, the way it's inserted into the heart, every time the heart contracts, it delivers, blood is delivered to the lungs and to the body, and as the heart is resting, it's not. So the thought process was, with the newer shunt, that less blood flow going to the heart when the heart is resting provides more blood for the heart itself, and so maybe better cardiac function. But the flip side of that is the way that shunt is inserted could have longer-term negative effects upon the heart, as hypothesized. So, was that your question, or did I get too far away from
that? Yeah, no, I just wanted to know, like, if you had a benefit to explain to the patient of why you were doing this, what was, you know, sort of the benefit of one shunt versus the other?
Right. So I thought the newer shunt may have protected the heart a little bit better mm-hmm. by providing more blood flow when the heart was resting, as opposed to the other type of the shunt. Was a potential thought. So maybe immediate benefit, but maybe not long term.
All right. So let's presume that the board has determined that all the criteria for approval are met, and now a motion has been made to approve it or approve it with a few minor clarifications or changes, and then somebody has to suggest a risk category. Who would think that it's greater? Who would think that? Would anyone think this is minimal risk? I mean, if the chances of receiving either procedure were the same on study or off study, is there anyone by a show of hands who would think this could be minimal risk? Okay, so greater than minimal risk wins. And now, is it greater than minimal risk with no direct benefit? If they're getting things that they would receive anyway, if everyone's going to have one of the surgeries anyway, who thinks it's greater than minimal risk with no direct benefit? So then everyone thinks it's greater than minimal risk with the potential for benefit? By a show of hands?
Well, okay.
It's
tough. It seems like from what you were describing, there is a potential for benefit if the newer surgery, you know, increases the blood flow and improves outcomes, you know. But it seems to me that it wouldn't be a minor increase over minimal risk. I guess because I'm thinking of it as being an invasive, such an invasive procedure. But you're saying it's, what do you base it on? That they're getting the surgery anyway. Are we considering that the surgery is research, either way.
Right. Right. So either way, they have to go to surgery, right? They have to have this type of surgery, and it's a modification of that type of surgery. But yes, it's the which shunt you're randomized to is research. And we are saying we don't know. One may offer earlier benefit, maybe long-term deficit. You have the offerings of the genetic eval and the neurodevelopmental eval, but does that really...
Can those offset? Are you allowed to think about those as benefits that can offset this risk?
I think you are, right? Because they're part of, they're offered as part of the study. But in the bigger question of.
You can, but if they're not offered till, if a large percentage of the population is expected not to survive to that point,
right. How does that really benefit?
Do they carry without getting into too much? I mean, so I guess it depends on whether or not somebody's odds of one treatment or the other walking into the door without the research study happening is 50-50, and then the research is also 50-50 versus walking into the hospital and their chances are 70-30, or they can enter the study and their chances are 50-50, one treatment or the other, both of which might, we don't know which is optimal. Right. It's tricky.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was a good one to present.
Yeah.
Because it's difficult.
Even talking about it, since it was so long ago,
we
don't remember exactly which one it was.
Right.
I mean, it's been closed for a long time.
It has been, right.
And I didn't want to cheat by looking at the minutes.
Yeah, you're a good person.
All right, so does anyone else have anything else to add? We can't approve it until we put it into a category.
Oh. I mean, do you ever think, oh, brother, we have to go to the secretary? To me, it seems like it's greater than minimal risk, and I'm not quite sure that, I don't know about the direct benefit. I don't think that, I'm not sure that you can take these other unrelated benefits that are just part of the study
I mean, I think, yeah. It's a tricky one. Should we move on to another tricky one?
I was going to say, the case you started with actually is perhaps the most challenging because you presented it as either procedure could actually be offered by the surgeon to the patient equally well. They might have that conversation. And the support trial, which was another, I'm sure you know well, the pediatric study, which generated tremendous controversy. People have argued that all you're doing is randomizing. The randomization per se is minimal risk, but it still seems uncomfortable, and that's why there's a long dialogue people can read about this, particularly around invasive procedures, like Mary Carol was saying. As if, I think that that alone caused some concerns, but it seems to me, I think you can argue that there's a reasonable potential for benefit to the participants.
Yeah.
There's is everyone familiar with the support trial to some extent? Do you want to give a few words about what it was and what it, because that's an interesting case, and there's a graphic that I can whip out.
The issue was if you give premature infants oxygen supplementally, you're trading off a potential risk of damaging their eyes with the potential for improving their outcome. And so it wasn't really known, sort of like this, where if you kept them at a lower range of the oxygen, that you have a better eye protective effect, but maybe you have a higher risk, or at a higher oxygen level. And people really didn't know. So they enrolled, as I recall, participants and randomized them to being tightly controlled in high or low, but they really said nothing about those potential risks, and that was the whole issue. And they argued that we really didn't know at the time, which was true. And then at the end of the study, it actually turned out that there was, in fact, a higher mortality, as I recall, in the children who were maintained at a lower oxygen level. And the parents have subsequently felt they weren't informed. There have been lawsuits about this. And there have been many, actually, OHRP initially sent a letter saying that the initial decision about not including those risks, that's what we're talking about, so I could study, what are the risks of each surgical procedure?
Right.
Not informing the parents was... not what was appropriate, and then there was like a whole firestorm about that. So they had an entire conference dedicated to this.
So in that study, they randomized people to one of two different like settings that, you know, at different oxygen concentrations. I might be speaking medically poorly, but without the study happening, the normal like exposure is somewhere in this curve, right? And what they did is they randomized people to two, you know, very possible settings within like a range of what is done, but the curve of what of the people that was were actually in the study was like this. So all of this stuff in here is sort of like astray from the norm. So when you talk about it, it's one thing, but I saw a talk with someone from OHRP about a year ago, justifying their criticisms of it. And then when they showed the data like in a graphic way, it really kind of hits home. We're like, oh yeah, it was quite different. So it's like that main area where people usually fall, no one was there in the study. You know? So like for most people, they had a different outcome than they would have had theoretically. So thank you for that.
And the way families were consented for this study, the PI was he was a cardiac intensivist, and usually he would do all the consenting, and he would go in great detail about the high risk procedure, the mortality, and he would describe the specifics of the shunts, and he didn't weigh too much or give a lot of weight to the neurodevelopmental or genetic. He really did concentrate on it seemed like families understood. I actually still follow all of these patients, the ones that are obviously alive. It seemed like they had a pretty good understanding. So I think he must have done a good job, but I could see, you know, if you just, you know, go into that depth of explaining, you know, one procedure versus the other and what we do and don't know about the outcomes.
Improving study, obviously.
What's that?
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
We did it anyways. So.
Which one? I think we might have time for one more.
Okay, we can try.
You don't remember how it was
approved?
We know it was greater than minimal risk. She thinks it might have been no benefit.
Yeah.
But I think the IRB might have seen a benefit to it.
So greater than minimal risk. No benefit.
No direct.
Commensurate with their experience, because they're going to have a surgery anyway.
Right.
So it was only a little bit greater than minimal. It didn't have to meet the 407.
Right.
Did it? Yes or no?
I think it was either 405 or 406. It was not.
Right. Not 407. Yeah.
I don't think we've ever done a 407. Right. We've come close to it a few times, and then someone comes back and says, you know what, the department doesn't want to do this anyway. The only physician in the whole department who's interested is the PI. No one else is going to jump, you know, or, you know, because of biases. Like sometimes someone will say, well, everyone just agrees that the way we do it now is fine. Why do we have to study this other thing which might not be fine? You have to have buy-in, too, from all levels.
Yeah, just the whole department, yeah. That is true.
Or for one reason or another, someone thought it was like not ethical or not important enough to know, you know.
Right, exactly, to figure out. All right, so we'll try and go through another one. This is a drug trial that we actually did do. It was approved. Again, it was infants with complex congenital heart disease, and they were randomized to receive either study drug or placebo, and were on study drug or placebo for the 14 months of life. So they were put on study drug shortly after a first surgery in the first month of life. And so the background as to why they thought that this would be an important study to do. The drug that was used in this study was given clinically, but not as standard of care. It was sort of, physician preference. They thought, though, the drug may be helpful and that it would help the heart function better after surgery and through that first year of life, allowing more energy for growth. And this group of children have stunted growth, and we think that impacts other parts of their life. So that was the background for the study. The way that was set up was that the institution had to agree to it, the department had to agree to it, before the researchers would approach any of the families for consent, had to make sure it was okay with the surgeon and cardiologist, that they agreed that they weren't going to put this child on the drug clinically, that they felt like there was enough of a question whether the child needed the drug, that they were willing to have their patient randomized. So again, the drug is used clinically in this patient population, but not as the standard of care. And so the infants were randomized shortly after first surgery and were on study drug for 14 months. The clinicians and parents were blinded to study drug assignments. And so the benefit was if you were on study drug and it did work the way we wanted it to work, then growth would be improved and heart function could also be improved. There was also an offering of neurodevelopmental evaluation at 14 months of age, similar to the other study. The risks that if you're on placebo and study drug works, then you're not getting the drug that would help the child. And also we had to have safety labs. All the patients were monitored closely for safety, of course. And although we tried to always have labs drawn at a time when they were clinically indicated, once in a while it would to fit into the windows. A child would be stuck just for the study, but rarely. And then the side effects of the drug were low blood pressure and electrolytes could be abnormal. So just other considerations that these subjects already had multiple adverse events, so trying to piece out which adverse events would be related to study drug as opposed to underlying diagnosis. There were a lot of other studies going on at the same time that may or may not have been compatible, and the researchers would work that out together. Okay, and then why don't we categorize this study then?
Sure. Well, it looks like the PI has already provided with their assumption that it's greater than minimal risk with potential for direct benefit.
Right.
I have a few questions that I would ask, but does anyone
need more information?
In the cheap seats? Is anyone up there? Sandy, do you have a question?
So if there's a placebo, don't you have to consider whether there's direct benefit to the placebo group?
You mean by virtue of the placebo effect, or?
No,
or,
I mean.
Oh, you mean
because they're not
other
getting.
Procedures.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not, if you're claiming that there's a direct benefit.
Right.
It has to be to both groups.
Right, and so the benefit for the placebo group here would be the close monitoring and also the neurodevelopmental evaluation at 14 months of age. And the absence of the adverse side effects of the drug.
I mean, it could also go both ways. Sometimes it's minimal risk to the placebo group because they're not being exposed to an unknown agent.
Right.
Unless, by the virtue of being on the placebo arm, they're being denied something that they would otherwise be on. So it can go either way, whether it would be minimal risk or greater than minimal risk. And in this case, this is available to them, but it's not part of standard of care. So what would the likelihood of these patients, 50-50, is it 10%?
Right, it was probably more 50.
Get it?
Yeah. At the time, it was more 50-50. It was really physician preference, and some physicians thought it didn't help. Some didn't like the fact that lab values could be abnormal or blood pressure could be low, and other physicians thought it was very important to help the heart function after surgery in that first year of life. So there was not, though, a standard of care. And again, there were a bunch of institutions involved, and in our institution, it really just depended upon the cardiologist. And so, but cardiologists who used it for all their patients and felt like it was essential for care would obviously not allow their patients to be part of the study. Any other questions?
How is the drug administered?
Orally, twice a day, though.
Okay.
Yeah, so it could be burdensome to the family, so I didn't put that in terms of risks, but the families would have to either come back to our institution or go to a local place for labs. They'd have to give study drug twice a day. They would come back for a 14-month visit, which was an echocardiogram, neurodevelopmental evaluation, but there were additional things asked from the family to be part of the study, questionnaires. And the flip side, they did get a lot of extra monitoring from the research and clinical team as part of the study.
Can I ask what kind of abnormal labs? Was this liver function, kidney function, things?
Yeah, electrolytes, which you could think of electrolytes as being a little bit more risky in this patient population because electrolytes can also lead to abnormal heart rhythms, and so they're already cardiac patients.
Okay.
And low blood pressure, obviously, is a concern for our cardiac kids.
Is this drug used in adults?
It is, yep. It is, yeah.
And is it standard of care in adults?
This in the family of, but for a different indication, yeah. Yeah, it is. And we did actually do a survey after to see if the results of this study changed clinical practice. And actually those results are being, because you know, you do a whole study and you share all the results and then see, well, did we actually impact clinical care from this study? And that's being assessed right now.
I think we're just about at
yeah,
time.
I think we are. Yeah, there are a few more, but yeah, I think we might be.
For those of you who have never been to an IRB meeting, the IRB meetings at Children's are open. You can contact me if you want to find out when there's a guest slot. We serve lunch. Do you have openings as well? Does everyone know if any anniversaries new to Boston University?
There's no difference. It didn't offer a benefit and didn't offer a harm.
But how was it, I'm sorry, how was it approved?
Oh, it was approved greater than minimal risk with potential for direct benefit.
With potential. Oh,
yep.
Great.
Yeah, I think in this case, being on placebo was a risk because you might not get
right.
something that you get.
Something right. that they, well, yeah, well, it was
being
tested.
Is that true? Right. Every placebo. You almost need a statistician on the IRB to figure this stuff out sometimes.
Right, right. But it is a question, the placebo arm of any study, right?
Yeah. Great. Thank you all.
Great honor.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you.